from Buffalo Toronto Public Media. This is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Good morning and welcome to What's Next. I'm Alex Simone, and today we'll be diving into hunger relief in Buffalo and around Western New York. Here to speak on the issue, we have University of Maryland Professor Jennifer Roberts, who focuses on public health and is a native of Buffalo's East Side, and Feed More Western New York Public Relations Manager Catherine Schick. How are you both doing today?
Great, thank you.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. And so, when you look at things like hunger relief and food insecurity, first of all, could you dive a little more into how you would define those topics, maybe?
So food insecurity is a lack of access to enough nutritious food to lead a healthy lifestyle. So, you know, a lot of people think of hunger and food insecurity as interchangeable terms, and oftentimes we do use them interchangeably because the word hunger is easily understood. Hunger is more of that physical sensation, where food insecurity really actually defines that lack of access. So a lot of people who may be experiencing food insecurity could also be experiencing things like poverty, lack of transportation, housing. So we do see a lot of those social determinants of health do go hand in hand. And certainly we know that food insecurity is on the rise here in Western New York across our rural, suburban, and cities. All types of different communities and zip codes are seeing a rise in food insecurity here in Western New York.
The thing that I would add to Catherine's definition is that it's not necessarily a steady state. So one of the aspects that USDA stated is was that food insecurity could occur at times. And the way I interpret that is you might have, you know, a bountiful amount of food at the beginning of a month, but maybe by the end of the month, the family is in a state of food insecurity. So it may not be just a constant steady state of always being in food and a food insecure status, but it may ebb and flow.
I think what Dr. Roberts said is so critical, and thank you so much for bringing that up. So many people can experience food insecurity even at certain times of year.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at Feed More Western New York, what we do is we provide nutritious food and support to community members through a variety of programs like our food bank distribution network that serves food pantries, soup kitchen shelters, and schools. And one of the things that we tend to hear from our food pantries and the schools we partner with is that people may experience food insecurity, especially families, during the summer months. When you are in school, mm-hmm. you have access to nutritious breakfast and lunch programs. So that could be two solid meals a day that your family is counting on. And when those programs may end during summer vacation, a lot of families could be experiencing food insecurity and really have to scramble to find ways to make up those missing meals that were a solid part of their reliance during the school year.
And I feel like that detail, nutritious food, right, is really, that's something that has always gotten me when, even, you know, when people talk about like the geographic access to food, right? I believe that's within a mile of healthy, nutritious food in an urban setting. That would be, if you're not within that distance, then that would be considered a food desert, right? And that nutritious aspect feels very important. Like, this isn't access to, as much as we might enjoy fast food, that doesn't necessarily qualify because it doesn't provide the same value mm-hmm. as far as your diet goes, right?
Yeah, that is exactly correct. I mean, I've heard the terms of instead of food desert, I've heard the term food swamps, meaning that instead of having healthy options, there's a lot of unhealthy options. And, you know, I often think of like, you know, if you have an adolescent who maybe has like $2 or $3, right? And if they're within close walking distance to a supermarket, they may be able to buy an apple, an orange, or, you know, for less than $3. But if they don't have that, they're going to go to the local the local corner store and maybe buy a bag of chips and a soda. And so, actually, nowadays, I don't know if you can get that for $3, but you kind of get the point I'm trying to make, where if you had a supermarket, you would have an opportunity to get, you know, a more nutritious option as opposed to just, you know, at a 7-Eleven or just a corner store where you're just getting kind of like these kind of high salty, high sugar options that are not very nutritious at all.
Yeah, and on the local scale, then, what do you see as some of those primary contributors? Is it maybe the financial aspect? Is it geographic? Is it, you know, is it, I guess, vehicle access, right? What are some of those primary, factors or issues that you see kind of cropping up?
All of the above. Certainly when you live in not close distance to a grocery store or a market where the healthy, nutritious food, and I should say affordable healthy, nutritious food is available, you are having to overcome a lot of barriers in order to get that. We know, as Dr. Roberts was saying, that oftentimes the cheap option, the, you know, high fat, high calorie, high salt content is oftentimes the cheaper option, and it's going to fill your belly more than, say, the same cost for a bag of apples, compounded by the fact that you may not live in close distance to a grocery store. You could be factoring in a 2-hour round trip on public transportation to access that grocery store. Of course, then you also have to account for the fact that some people even have to add in the cost of childcare to watch a child as they're trying to manage, you know, getting those groceries for the day. So we know that nutritious access is a really big issue, not just in our cities, but our rural communities as well. One of the ways Feed More Western New York does work to address that is through our farm market program. It's actually a mobile market where we provide fresh, affordable produce for sale, and we go into areas where such fresh food is hard to come by. So that could be going into an area that is considered a food desert, but we also make stops at places like senior housing complexes because mobility challenges could also be a barrier to accessing nutritious food as well.
And I agree with everything, you know, that Catherine has said. It's a mosaic of all those issues, and some may be more so than others. You know, it may be more of a transportation issue, maybe more of an issue with income. And this is something that it actually triggered a memory that, you know, when I was a kid, it was just my mom and I, and we lived on a street called Eastwood, which is literally parallel to Canisius College, or now Canisius University. And I have vivid memories where my mom and I would walk to Main Street, cross Main Street, and then cut through Forest Lawn Cemetery. And we had this, like, cart that she would kind of, like, carry for groceries, but the reason why this memory was triggered, because Catherine said sometimes people may not have money for childcare. So I remember my mom at the corner of Delaware, there was a grocery store. She would tell me to just wait really at the entrance of Forest Lawn, and I would sit at the corner in the grass, and she would go grocery shopping at the grocery store that was over there. I was probably like, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8. And she would tell me to wait, you know? And this was, you know, the early 80s. And, you know, you didn't think anything was going to happen. But something is simple. She didn't have anyone to just watch me at home. So I went with her on this track. And then we would, you know, take the the like little trolley kind of thing, not a trolley, but like a cart of the groceries and carry them back through. And so it, that memory just triggered as soon as you said the whole idea of not having like childcare to watch while you need to go grocery shopping. So,
and from your standpoint, I feel like it's so interesting too, because you look at a lot of these Buffalo topics, but you introduce them to a population who doesn't really have the same, maybe local understanding, right, of what the actual Buffalo community is like, or Western New York as a whole, right? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, talking with your students at the University of Maryland, what does that do as far as bringing in maybe a different perspective to and you know, problem solving and, you know, looking at different solutions when they're, you know, they're from other areas.
Right.
They don't have, you know, maybe certain prior thought processes on the area.
Well, Alex, there's some commonalities that can be extended, particularly if you're talking about other type of Rust Belt cities. There's some things that are common. There's one thing that's really kind of just throughout the United States is that you have a lot of cities that are still very much segregated. You have a lot of cities that are still very much kind of two halves of a city. And that's one aspect that is common. I live in Baltimore now, and you have those same kind of issues. And so when I talk about this to people from other areas, they can actually map these kind of common themes to where they come from. And they can see like, oh, okay, I understand where, you know, your quote East Side, that was our North Side, you know, and they can kind of understand that and relate to a certain degree. And so I think it's more about these broader issues in terms of how all of these social drivers impact us. It may not be in Buffalo, but if you say City A and City B, there's certainly things that are very much common, particularly if you look at certain generational patterns. So it's very much, you know, not only sometimes with my students who are now, you know, I guess it's the I can't keep track of
Gen Z.
Thank you, the Gen Z. You know, it's very different than when I was coming up, and so you sometimes have to kind of help them extrapolate from that generation to the current generation. But once you do that, they can very much see certain commonalities between Buffalo and where they live.
So at that point, it's almost like a unifying thing.
Yes, it definitely is a unifying thing. Definitely,
and you know, I am interested. So I feel like kind of similar, like you said, working with different age groups as well, Catherine, you know, I feel like kind of similar from that standpoint. Are there certain like food items and maybe, I don't know, trying to think about the typical food pyramid, right? which seems a little outdated now. But are there certain things that you tend toward maybe promoting for maybe different age groups, different, you know, maybe depending on dietary restrictions, you know, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we do address that in a variety of ways at Feed More. Our mission is to provide nutritious food to people of all ages and backgrounds, and we do reach a wide swath of people, not just in terms of age. We really do provide a continuum of care, from providing nutritious food through our partner agencies and school systems to babies and children, all the way through older adults, maybe served by our home-delivered meal program, which provides nutritious meals to our seniors and people who are homebound, who cannot get out of the house to shop or prepare for food. And the way we try to address that is, you know, having these targeted programs. So for children, we have what's called a Kids in the Kitchen program. It's one of our nutrition education opportunities where we're actually going into classrooms and community groups and teaching about healthy food and introducing them to healthy food and basic meal prep and really trying to, any, you know, break down any barriers in terms of, you know, getting acquainted with these types of food products and really being able to control, you know, on your own terms as a child, you know, what you're able to prepare for as a snack. So all of those classes do provide ingredients and recipes to take home so they can actually share what they have learned with their family as well and try it at home. And then, you know, on the older adult side, we are providing, medically tailored meals for our community members with maybe specific dietary needs. So we have a renal diet for our older adults for, you know, maybe experiencing kidney disease or kidney problems. We have a diabetes friendly diet, a ground diet, a bland diet, and all of these, you know, diets are meeting at least one third of the RDA. So having different ways through targeted feeding programs based on, you know, those age demographics and you know, corresponding needs is one of the ways we're trying to make sure that we're providing the right nutritious food to our community members based on where they are in life. Another way we're really trying to work to address those specifics is working closely with our agencies. We provide food to at least about 400 hunger relief partners throughout Erie, Niagara, Cattaraugus, and Chautauqua County. How we work is we have a food bank distribution network where we take in those donations of food and funds that we use to purchase food, and then we distribute them to those pantries, those soup kitchens, those shelters who open their doors to serve the community members in their neighborhoods. So we're always working closely with our agency partners, and they tell us what they need based on what their community is asking for. So one of the things that our agencies have been requesting lately is a lot more halal food. So we're working on sourcing those items to make sure that we're providing a range of product that is going to meet the very, you know, various cultural needs, preferences, you know, from age, background, and where people live throughout our service area.
So it sounds like the equation, the consideration isn't really just access for the consumer base, you know, for these residents. It's also a question of making sure that you can access those things to then get them out there to the residents, right?
That's right. You know, so, you know, one of the ways in our outreach is, you know, we're always trying to encourage, you know, food drives. If you want to hold a specialty food drive, we're actually going to be holding a allergen-friendly food drive coming up to, you know, make sure that we have access to foods that could help people who may also have very common food allergies. So, you know, having that outreach of, you know, our most needed items is something that we're always working with the community to make them aware of. And then, you know, having those funding sources so we are able to purchase the food that may not have been donated to us, but we know are in high demand by the agencies and community members that they serve.
And when it comes to that outreach aspect and promoting your message, what's maybe the most important one or two aspects, again, especially across such a large geographic area?
Yeah. So I think Feed More, you know, can be top of mind for people during times of an emergency, whether that's a community crisis, a weather event. And one of the main messages that we want people to know is that Feed More Western New York is here even outside of emergencies. You may not always see us because you may be more acquainted with the neighborhood pantry you visit because, you know, we're partnering with a range of pantries throughout our four county service area. So you may be more familiar with the pantry, you know, that you go to at the place you worship, and you may not realize that they're a partner of Feed More Western New York because we're working behind the scenes with them. But we do have a variety of programs outside of those times of emergencies, whether that is that farm market that I mentioned that goes into communities with fresh, affordable produce, our various nutrition education classes, those home-delivered meals. We want to make sure that we're able to be there for the community because, as we were talking about, you know, just a few moments ago, we know that food insecurity is on the rise. Just last year alone, Feed More Western New York saw a 16% increase in the amount of people turning to Feed More for nutritious food and support. Over the past 3 years, it's actually been about 46%. So we know that, again, the need is continuing to grow. And we hope that one of the reasons that we're seeing an additional surge in need at Feed More and an additional show of people who are relying on our services is because of those outreach efforts, because We know that people are out there, whether that is a sudden loss of job, whether that is a long-term need for food insecurity, whatever, or, I'm sorry, for food assistance, whatever that may be, we know that people are out there who need this type of help. And we want to make sure we're doing everything we can in terms of outreach to make sure that people know that this is a resource available to them.
And I feel like that's that geographic aspect again, right? You know, especially from an academic standpoint, Jennifer, like, is it, when you're looking at stuff, right, is it any different looking at, let's say, a place like, right, of course, a place like Buffalo, right? And it's easy to say, well, Buffalo is different being a more urban center than like an Olean, right, which mm-hmm. is much more rural. But from that standpoint, does it also increase maybe certain concerns you think, you know, as far as like, I guess, at least, you know, maybe Buffalo, there are certain concerns that are higher, but also like there are at least more food places in the city, right? To, you know, whereas like Olean, it might be, well, maybe you have one shopping center, you know, mm-hmm. something like that. So, you know, I guess when you look at maybe different geographic areas, how does that equation change from maybe an academic standpoint, I guess?
Well, I know that, I mean, that's a really good question. But I do know that, you know, when the government was changing these kind of definitions or kind of trying to define, quote unquote, food deserts, if it was a more rural area, I think it went out to more like 5 miles, mm-hmm. I think. Yep. But then there was some stipulation whether or not you owned a vehicle. So there's different factors that come into place when you're talking about the spatial dynamics. But I think within the city, you have a tendency sometimes to just get lost, even though it may be closer to more quote unquote options. Those options may not be necessarily the best options. And then sometimes also, if you think about in a rural area, you may have an option that a lot of people don't think about it in the urban area, and that is, let me just try and grow something. You may actually have a little plot of land to say, okay, let me, you know, get some seed and grow some lettuce and grow some tomatoes, where you may not have that if you live in a high rise, you know. So there's different complexities in terms of, you know, a more rural area versus a more urban area in terms of the likelihood of being able to access healthy and nutritious foods and being able to have those, a variety of those options to actually access those foods.
Yeah, and how, for both, how difficult do you think that maybe consideration would be, or maybe that conversation is to have with somebody when it's like, I could tell you that, hey, go grow some of your own food, but at the same time, if you need that food now, telling you to grow your own food isn't, I mean, there's only mm-hmm. so much, because you gotta wait then. You can't,
yeah.
If I need, you know, if I'm trying to get fruits and vegetables now, I can't necessarily wait around for 6 weeks until, you know, it all, mm-hmm. or 6 weeks seems a little short. But anyway, yeah. You know, until it's ready to be eaten, right?
I think there's definitely an education component. An education component and a component of making it as easy as possible. So I know some farmers markets, like I lived in the Chicago area at one point, and you would have some kind of farmers markets that would actually kind of be set up like kind of adjacent to or in a parking lot near a grocery store, and they would have like other options of different types of fruit, but then they would also say, hey, here's a tomato plant. So it would help. So, and I remember that was literally the first time I started thinking about growing, and they were like, no, this just skips the whole germination phase, just put it in the ground. And within I don't know how many weeks, but I actually started to have, like, you know, 6 or 7 green tomatoes. And then, you know, oh, if they're going to turn red. So yes, there's some preparation, but if just like a little bit of education and helping people to kind of be able to necessarily prepare. And then the other thing about that, those same tomatoes, they started to grow really quickly. And then to know that, oh, I could freeze these and then make some tomato sauce. So I think just helping people to get a little informed and saying, oh, maybe I can do this, you know, because it's not necessarily intuitive, especially if you live in an urban area and you have never grown anything or no one like told you about growing things. So I think just helping people with a little bit of education can help like fill in some of those holes.
listening to all of that is, it helps me sort of, it brings to mind the fact that, you know, a lot of the work that we do at Feed More and a tenant that a lot of the, you know, food banks that we work with, you know, across our region, it's so important that we have to do both. You mentioned, what if you're hungry, you can't wait. We want to feed the line of those who need food assistance in the immediate sense, but also ultimately shorten the line. So you're talking a lot about education, and one of the ways that, you know, we're working to do that and in a related way at Feed More West New York is not just through nutrition education opportunities, but also through our workforce development program. We know that unemployment and underemployment is a root cause of poverty and food insecurity. So in addition to those immediate sort of safety net services, we also feel it's really important to make sure that we're addressing root causes of food insecurity as well, whether that's, you know, trying to find ways to you know, encourage more opportunity for affordable food, the education, and then with our workforce development program, we're actually offering free courses in a warehousing and logistics environment. So you can actually get the certifications that are really going to be attractive for any type of profession in a warehousing and logistics career, as well as a culinary arts program as well. So two different training tracks right now. And in addition to offering those hard skills, we're also teaching soft skills, how to interview for a job, financial literacy, the nutrition education component, and trying to break down some of those immediate barriers, as we were talking about, whether that's helping with childcare, helping with transportation, helping with food assistance. So you can really focus on that education part. So I really like what you were saying, Dr. Roberts, and it just made me think of the fact that we need to be doing both. We need to, mm-hmm. you know, shorten the line of people who need food assistance while making sure that we're taking care of immediate needs as well. Mm-hmm.
I think that's about all the time we have for this episode of What's Next, but I do want to thank our guests, Professor Jennifer Roberts from the University of Maryland and Catherine Schick from Feed More Western New York. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back with more What's Next after this.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Good morning. This is What's Next, and my name is Akua Menzedu. I am the president of Clementine Gold Group. Today, we are excited to talk about women in construction and DEI, and we're joined by Jillian Penkin, who is the founder of Penkin Consulting and also the Northeast Region Director of NAWIC, which stands for National Association for Women in Construction. Welcome, Jillian.
Hi. Nice
we're excited to have you.
Thank you.
So I just want to get a little bit of understanding about your background, right? How did you get into construction? And what made you want to get into that space?
So I think, like so many other women that end up in construction, by accident.
Okay.
I think you either end up in construction because it was your passion, it was a family business, and you were meant to be in construction, or you ended up there by accident, and that was my path.
Okay.
I happened to be 21. And I was in a bar with my sister and one of our very good friends. The company that she worked for was looking for an admin assistant, and it was an HVAC company. And she asked me if I would apply, and the rest is history. I got the job like right away and fell in love with the industry from there, and just grew.
So what type of roles did you have, right? So starting working for that HVAC company, what else did you do in your career?
So I started at a small, not small, but a family-owned HVAC company in Rochester. And I was lucky that I worked very closely with the owners.
Okay.
And so they saw in me what I saw in me, passion and intelligence, and they invested in my future and worked alongside me, and they helped get me certifications, helped invest in me, get me education so that I could become an assistant project manager, a project manager, and really help run the show. And so until I outgrew them, and then I went to a controls company, and I worked in accounting, and I worked in project management, and then sales. And then I outgrew them, and I went to a flooring contractor, and I was there for a number of years, and I was a top sales rep there, and I was project management there, and I don't know, luck, a little luck, a lot of hard work.
Yeah. So, you know, I know you talked about 15 years, right, being in the industry, and so what inspired you to leap, to start your own firm, right? So you have Penkin Consulting. How did you go from working in and with other folks to directly on your own?
The industry is really interesting, right? I think most people use the phrase that it's male dominated. Mm-hmm. I go out of my way not to. I say it's male clustered.
Okay.
Right? Because we are not dominated by the men that we work with, but there sure are a lot of them.
Yeah.
And because of that, sometimes it can be a really difficult industry to work in. Mm-hmm. And what I needed was a space where I could learn and not be intimidated.
Okay.
And I found that with NAWIC, mm-hmm. the National Association of Women in Construction. Shortly before I started with that construction company, my mom passed. And it was a really difficult time in my life. I was 20 years old and had just graduated college. And you don't really know where you are in life at that time. I mean, none of us really do, right? Yeah. And to lose the most important woman in my life made it all the harder. And I needed a place and a space where I could learn how to be a professional person and find mentorship. And NAWIC provided that. So I was very lucky to have that. Mm-hmm. And that's, I know for sure that that's where I got a lot of my strength and my passion and my confidence. And as I grew in those 15 years in this industry, if anybody that knows me would say, she's really strong. Jillian is really strong. She is very confident. Do not mess with her, right? And the last 2 years of my time as an employee in this industry were probably the most difficult of all of my 15 years in the industry. Emotionally, mentally, physically, every day was tears. Okay. And I'm not above saying I'm a crybaby. I am a crybaby. but it was, I don't even think I have the words to describe it. And I'm a writer. I got all the words. And it made me question why I worked so hard to bring other women into this industry and question if I could stay in this industry and what I had been working so hard towards.
Right.
And so I finally just said, life is too short to just keep working this hard. And for what?
Yeah.
And so that's exactly when I finally decided it was time to start Penkin Consulting. And not only make a better life for myself, but a better life for everyone else, mm-hmm. other employers to have a better outcome for them and for other employees, better satisfaction for them.
Yeah. So, I mean, and it sounds like you were in a challenging space and you decided, okay, I've had enough. I want to do something else, you know, get into the space. And so talk about what it is that you do through your consulting firm at this point. What are you doing and how are you helping other women? Because it sounds like, you know, we had a conversation before you started to get into that. So how do you describe what it is that you do with those organizations?
So I do a lot of assessment, right? I go into other companies or I talk to other leaders, owners, executives, and try to assess why they're maybe having issues with employee retention or employee dissatisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
Every company has those, what I call friction fixers, right? That one or two or three, if they're very lucky, handful of employees that are just incredible, mm-hmm. and then they lose them or they're about to lose them. And try and figure out why. Why is that happening? And a lot of times it might be their culture doesn't feel so great.
Right, right.
A lot of times their value statement doesn't match the values that they feel internally.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Their talk isn't matching their walk, right? And so I want them to understand that they can change that. And it takes investing in their employees in a different way. It's not always about money. You do need to pay your people.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. I mean, and that's just Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like, you need to make sure that you are providing your employees are not... If you're working 40 hours a week, you should be able to feed yourself,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But you should also be able to have a psychologically safe environment, you know, where you're not feeling nervous to speak up or as an employee that you're allowed to make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
We're all going to make mistakes.
Right, right.
But that you're not going to make one mistake and get fired for it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the journey of what you're talking about, obviously it hits into this diversity, equity, and inclusion space. And I know you mentioned that you're a very strong advocate of DEI. Obviously, there's been a lot of challenges, you know, with executive orders and things that have come up. And so I'm wondering how that's impacted the work that you do. Have you seen any folks kind of veering away from centering conversation in their organization around that as well?
Absolutely. And it is personally very disappointing to see companies pull away from policies that they said were very important to them.
Mm-hmm.
And to any decision maker that's listening, I hope that you know that your employees are not stupid, right? They know what was on your company website, and they know what's on it today.
Right.
So if you took a policy off, if you took wording off of your company website, they know that. They also know if you're choosing to say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's the worst thing you can do, is stay silent. We all watch the news. We all know what's going on. And choosing to say nothing is sometimes even louder.
Right.
And very rarely do we fill in the blanks with the best case scenarios, right? Transparency, I think, is so important.
Mm-hmm.
From leadership to all of our teams, have a conversation. Be that thought leader. Lead your teams in the best way possible.
Mm-hmm.
Provide that space so that your employees can have conversations with each other. That's a great way to create that safe space, even if you maybe don't share the same thoughts, opinions, and values.
Right.
Of course, I hope you do. I hope that you all do support diversity, equity, and inclusion. But a lot of times, I feel like the folks that don't, it's because they don't understand what it means. So I recently, you know, I have a blog on my website, and I just shared the definitions of these words: diverse, diversity,
mm-hmm,
equity, equitable, inclusion. Because I think we do ourselves such a disservice by continually saying DEI instead of saying all of the words. Because we kind of acronym ourselves to death.
Right.
Construction is great at that. Oh my God. Do we have, I mean, every industry, right? But oh, we have an acronym for just about everything. I mean, we were looking a few up earlier, weren't we? But if someone says that they don't support DEI, well, what don't you support? What mm-hmm does that stand for?
Mm-hmm.
You don't support what?
And there's been a lot of conversations, I think, even showing how much support increases once folks really understand what it means and how it lends itself in the organization as well. And so I know earlier we started to talk a little bit about like Title VII and Title IX. And I wanted to just get your insights around, you know, the challenges around those and how that's impacting your business and the businesses that you help at this point.
I have so many examples and it really does. It breaks my heart. And because these are people I know personally that are impacted immediately, and also children in our community, in our Buffalo.
Right, right.
In our Buffalo that are immediately impacted negatively by the changes in this administration. And another thing I do in my business is I talk and I use history.
Okay.
Specifically women's history. That's my favorite.
Right.
Because I think it's important. I think in order to know where we are going, we have to know where we've been. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we've always, whatever we think we're doing that's new, we've already done
right.
it. And when we talk about what Title IX and what Title VII is, this comes from our civil rights amendments. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times when people think about the civil rights movement, it's very interesting because we all have a lens with which we look at the world. Mm-hmm. And depending on your lens, you might think of the 60s and the 70s, and it might be, you know, Betty Friedan, or it might be Martin Luther King, and you might think, oh, this was just all roses and a march,
right.
or, you know, that it was very pleasant. And it we know, right, if you know history, if you studied history, that it wasn't. Mm-hmm. But it was a very important time, and it gave us such important rights and accesses and freedoms that we maybe take for granted today. And to tie it to construction, right, to what I spend so much time talking about, the reason we have vocational schools and trade programs can tie it right back to Title IX, mm-hmm. which by definition is, it prohibits discrimination in federally funded programs for any education or any educational program, K through 12, university, and also any activity. Mm-hmm. So locally, recently, even just during WIC Week, the first week in March, Women in Construction Week, mm-hmm. which NAWIC started, by the way, in 1998, the NAWIC Buffalo chapter had to cancel an event that we had 70, I think, school buses got canceled because OFCCP lost some funding. Mm-hmm. And so these schools and all these kids had to lose their day with NAWIC. And it was just so sad. And I didn't really realize the impact of that until a friend sent me a Facebook post and asked me if I knew about that. And it was a parent that heard, you know, her daughter wasn't able to come be with us for the day. Mm. And her daughter was really looking forward to spending the day, the career in construction day, with the women of NAWIC. And it was just one example.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, a challenge to get, I think, women interested in this specific trade, construction as it is, right? And so there's a lot of conversations around starting younger in terms of exposure. And so I can only imagine, you know, how many, you said 70 schools, right? Like being impacted by that. What about some of the challenges in construction that we're still facing today, right? And so access to mentorship, right? Hygiene-friendly restrooms and areas for women to have for themselves. Like what other things are you seeing from that standpoint?
When I talk about construction, I think it is a microcosm for our world. Mm-hmm. It is just a heavily concentrated look at every community. Because every problem that we have in construction is every problem that women face in every other market, in every other industry. It's just a little bit, maybe, more difficult because we are so densely populated with men. And it is maybe a little bit more misogynistic or patriarchal.
Okay.
Because we are, most decisions made in the construction industry are made by men and for men first. So the construction industry is a 90-10 industry. It is 90% men and 10% women. And of the 10% women in the industry, 6% work in leadership, office-type positions. They might not even set foot on a job site.
Okay.
The 4% that are skilled trades, that number gets broken down even farther than when you try and look at women of color, Black women, the LGBTQ community, mm-hmm. the marginalized communities of women in construction, when you try and think about the diversity, equity, and inclusion conversation. Mm-hmm. I think that's why so many construction companies were so quick to cut off those policies and not think about how that would impact their employees.
Yeah.
So that's one. Childcare or family care, mm-hmm. right? Both ends, right? Adult and senior care, and also for your children. So keeping women working in the construction industry, if you think about showing up at a job site, if you need to be there at 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning, how many daycare centers are open
right.
and ready to go? But also, think about what time you would have to wake up, get your little family ready to go, up and out the door. And also, if you're on a job site and your little one gets sick, and we know most women take on the brunt of family issues, mm-hmm. right? Taking care of the kids. I'm not saying it's right. In fact, I will loudly say it's wrong.
Right, right.
But that makes it really difficult. There's such a barrier because of family care for women in the trades. Mm-hmm. The National Association of Women in Construction has done a number of studies and a lot of outreach to try and help, as have a number of other organizations. You know, construction is not the only issue, and a lot of times, money. Money's the answer. There are so many mental load privileges that maybe men take for granted, mm-hmm. and we don't get to take advantage of as women in the industry. It's what maybe makes us such fabulous project managers. If you ask anyone in the industry, women are known to be better project managers. But it's also because we're just better. We are asked to be mm-hmm. better in the home, right? To make the list. Oh, I'll go grocery shopping, but what do we need? Well, you live here too. I'm sorry, what were we going to say?
Yeah, no, I and so when you think about practical ways that construction companies and firms can create more inclusive environments, like what things come to mind, right? So work-life balance is an mm-hmm. issue in many industries, but I, you know, to your point, you're on a site, you're out in the field, right? It's a lot more difficult to kind of manage those things. So what do you think companies can do to start to shift some of those, you know, opportunities to become more inclusive?
I think that companies need to not be so afraid to ask the question of their employees, what do they need to feel included in the conversation and the decision-making space. I think a lot of it goes back to that psychological safety, right? Mm-hmm. Women so often feel like, whether they're in the trades or in the office, they don't want to make themselves stand out as the problem. They'll really common, and if there are any tradeswomen listening, they will laugh at this part. A lot of women in the trades know the trick to stuff toilet paper in their hard hat because there won't be any in
oh, wow.
in the port-a-john.
Okay.
Or it's so gross. You know what I mean? It's just safer to bring your own. And we always need toilet paper, right?
Right.
Whereas sometimes men can get away with not having any, right? Some job sites will have one port-a-john locked for women. Like, the, you know, they may have one or two women on site, or hopefully more,
right.
You know, hopefully a lot more. So they'll have one port-a-john locked so that when it comes time for, you know, the use of the, yeah, the Port-a-John, that one won't be as abysmal. But when a lot of times the women don't want to single themselves out to go and get the key from the job trailer and then use that one and then go and bring the key back to the job trailer, because it's just, they just want to be seen like everyone else on site. Yeah. Like we all do. You know what I mean? We don't want to see the color pink used as punishment, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Like you showed up late or you didn't use the right lockout tag, whatever it is. So now you have to wear the pink vest. We don't want to see all of the girly things, all of the women items be used as punishment. We don't want to single ourselves out.
Yeah.
We don't want to use the phrase for woman instead of foreman. It's foreman. We're a foreman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just ask us. Don't try and fix a problem that isn't, don't try and fix something that isn't broken.
Right.
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 Just ask. Yeah. I think that's what a lot of employers or decision makers can do, is just ask the question. Get, which is exactly feedback, what we're doing here, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And so we only have a few minutes left. And so I want to think about the future, right? And so when you think about the future, and obviously you're in this space every day, what changes would you love to see in the construction industry over the next 5 years?
I would love to see some meaningful increase of women come into this industry and be able to stay. Because it seems like there's a sieve. We leak like a sieve. Mm-hmm. A lot of women do come into the industry and leave because the mentorship is just not there and the sponsorship is not there. Meaning, when I say sponsorship, I mean that someone will actually take these women by the hand, walk them into the room, and introduce them to the decision makers, the next, get them to the next level in their career. Mm-hmm. Who is going to help them learn and grow and become that next leader? We need more of those sponsors. Mm-hmm. I would love to see more of that. I think that that's how we really grow. We get out of that 90-10. Maybe we become that 85-15. I would love to see that happen. I would love to see more companies find a way to creatively work around in a way that makes sense for them, diversity, equity, and inclusion. If they are going after projects with federal funding, and that is the reason why they made the decision to take that off their website, I understand. Mm-hmm. Make sure that your employees understand that. And make sure that your culture still represents that you do care about diversity, equity, and inclusion. You don't need the words on your website for people to feel it. Because that policy was always about ethics, the ethical imperative anyway, right? I would love to see more business cases come out for how diversity, equity, and inclusion makes sense and what this next chapter is going to look like as we move forward, and more conversations come out about mental health awareness, and really have those thought leaders come forward about how coaching and working together makes sense. There's so much research and education available. Let's read it. Let's understand it and unpack it. And I would love to see more people come to our NAWIC meetings. And we really have so many incredible subject matter experts. We are in every state, in every city, 6,000 women nationwide, leaders like you wouldn't believe, just incredible women that are life-changing, career-changing to meet. I'm just one lady. I'm nobody. The women that make up this organization are unstoppable.
Awesome. Well, Jillian, I want to thank you for coming on and chatting with us. We were talking with Jillian Penkin, who is the founder of Penkin Consulting and the Northeast Region Director of the National Association for Women in Construction. Thank you for coming on and sharing with us.
Thank you.